There's a time and a place for Filet-O-Fish. But breakfast is for sausage biscuits. McDonald's breakfast comes first. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network. I continue my conversation with Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution, writing about a Supreme Court case now under review by the court, by the justices, Cedar Point Nursery versus Hasid, having to do with when and if a labor organization has the right to enter private property to organize. I learned from Richard, I think, that there's a before and after the New Deal. The before is Adair versus the United States, 1908, and Cappage versus Kansas, 1915, that established that the United States nor any of the states in the United States have the power to force an employer to negotiate collectively. And then it comes along the New Deal. And I take it, Richard, from this, the New Deal knew what it was doing and changed everything purposefully. Is that correct?
That is certainly correct. And there was a huge judicial revolution to go along with it. It's like everything else. It went in spits and starts. But the basic intuition that you had back in 1908 and 1915 was, in the first case, you had somebody come along talking about the railroads, I believe it was, and said, you know, the employer is now under duty to deal in good faith with workers. And the judge said, no, this is a case in which it's liberty of contract, which means that you have to have some strong justification before you could override the ability of anybody, an employer or otherwise, to refuse to deal. These are not cases where there were common carriers, the only person who provided the service. There were other places that you could work, other railroads, other firms, and so forth. So the general rule is that the only way you could make a contract was to get the assent of both parties. And since these statutes purported to change those kinds of arrangements in one way or another, they were struck down both at the federal level and then at the state level. The erosion actually begins before the decisive cases in 1937, and these decisions, including another one called dealing with the so-called Yellow Dog contract, that is a contract in which workers agree not to work for a union so long as they remain in employment with somebody else. That was also upheld in a case called Hitchman Coal in about 1916 or 17. And then starting in the 1930s, this whole structure started to topple, at which particular point you then induce the mandatory duties for collective bargaining. They were officially sanctioned in a case called Jones and Laughlin against the NLRB. Interestingly enough, the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, had lost this case in three different circuit courts, and it came up to the Supreme Court, and to the amazement of most people at the time, it reversed them and said the federal government has the power under the Commerce Clause to regulate local manufacture and so therefore local unionization, which was something of a surprise. And then they made it very clear that arguments pertaining to economic liberties did not give, in quote-unquote, the inequality of bargaining power and the need to secure industrial peace, give a justification for saying that the management could stay away. So that's what set the framework. And then you have a series of decisions, some pro-union, some anti-union. But the trespass issue first becomes before the court in 1945 in a case called Republic Aviation, where they said workers can congregate in order to deal collectively. And even if management had a rule that was long in place and had nothing to do with unions, when it was enacted, they couldn't apply it. And then in 1956, they had another rule saying when it was that union people were allowed to come on the plans. So it was a very sharp discontinuity between the pre- and the post-1930s, 1937 cases, as you suggested.
Justice Scalia seizes upon the word permanent in one of these arguments about do you or do you not have the right to trespass for your activity. Justice Kagan, in the oral arguments you identify, seized upon the word intermittent. This turns on the Ninth Circuit, that's the predicate for this case before the Supreme Court, believing that there is not an easement. Now, all of this adds up to one great big stew that comes this way. Is the Supreme Court going to strike down CALRA? Because that's the fundamental that's driving this, right? The California law.
Yes, there's no question. What happened is the Pacific Legal Foundation, which argued this case, basically took a position which is very similar to the one that I took in 1985 when I wrote my book, Taking. And the basic theory then is that the moment you break the plane, i.e. you invade somebody else's space, That's the taking, and then the duration of the particular taking only goes to the question of damages. The issue of an injunction is such that if it's a casual taking with no likelihood of repetition, nobody would ever think of an injunction. But if you have a statute which says you could come on the property 30 days a year, well, obviously that's a repetitive situation, so you would be able to get that injunction to make sure that you could keep the sanctity of property alive, given the absence of these other justifications. So that's the position. People like, for example, Justice Barrett in this particular case, she wanted to know whether or not you would apply the same rule if it turned out you knew that the entries would only take for 1 hour every year. The lawyer answered, absolutely, that is the correct answer under these circumstances. But Judge Barrett, or Justice Barrett and Justice Kagan, both kind of are balancers in the way in which they think these things. And so their kind of argument, if the intrusion is small enough and the need is great enough for the laboring guys, what we do is we balance the inconvenience of the employer to the inconvenience of the union, and we say maybe 40 hours is fine, but if they go beyond that by making noise and so forth, we'll strike them down. I think it's more likely that in this particular court that that position will win. And that's because this is not a 6-3 conservative majority. The way to understand the current Supreme Court, at a guess, is there are three liberals. Those are Kagan and Breyer and Sotomayor. There are three kinds of conservatives, a little quirky from time to time, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. And then there are three moderately conservative judges, Barrett, Kavanaugh, and Roberts. But there's a fair bit of ideological spread between those three and the other three on the right. And in this particular case, my guess is that the middle three will find that there is a violation of the rights of the employer, but they will do so under the California Labor Relations Act for the agriculture rather than strike down the entire statute. I think it's a mistake, but if they want to go the other way, then essentially they've dismantled the entire labor system in the United States, because if employers can keep workers out as a matter of constitutional right when there's no agreement, all collective bargaining agreements fall. And I'm quite happy with that sort of result and have been so for many, many years, because I think labor unions in many cases are just undue monopoly power in the worst possible way in terms of the way in which plants and businesses operate. But I think the Supreme Court is going to be much more incrementalist on that. My position is certainly, shall we say, not taken by nobody, but it's taken by relatively few people. But it's interesting, John, how it is that the differences in major philosophical position can work about the question, does it make a difference whether an easement is permanent or intermittent? And the entire labor statute may turn on that particular distinction if, in fact, the six majorities, as I predict, it will hold. So my guess is there will be at least six votes that will vote to affirm, because the middle three conservatives will turn liberal on this issue. Not on all issues, but on this one.
In your 1985 book, you quote in this article, "And the puzzle here is, was the mistake made in the New Deal?" You write, "The system of limited government and private property is not elastic enough to accommodate the massive reforms of the New Deal." Does that remain a problem all these decades later? The New Deal was
absolutely
irregular, and no one can correct it?
Look, there's always the problem in legal history that when institutions are established for a long period of time, it's very difficult to get rid of them simply because the cost of trying to re-engineer the systems are extremely high. It's a kind of like a prescriptive right. You trespass on somebody's land long enough, it's a repeated trespass. It goes on for 20 years, it's now an easement. That is something as a right. So one of the great mysteries that you have in all legal system is, why is it that successive wrongs really compound themselves up to a certain point, and then bingo, statutes of limitations, prescription rights take over and flip things the other way. I don't think that analogy applies exactly in this particular case, because I think it's possible to undo the labor statutes without having the kind of gut-wrenching situations that you might have in other situations, but people will disagree on that particular situation. So there is no question that it's a lot harder to strike down a statute which you think to be facially unconstitutional if it's been in effect now for 85 years, like the National Labor Relations Act has, as opposed to simply affirming the decisions of the lower courts when Jones and Laughlin came up to the United States Supreme Court in 1937, and they said this stuff is dealing with local manufacture, not interstate commerce, and we have these other precedents having to do with economic liberty. So the traditional barriers against the National Labor Relations Act were both overcome. One of them dealt with the freedom of contract. The other dealt with the limits of federal power. This particular case, since it's a state regulation, you don't face the federalism issue as you do with the National Labor Relations Act, but you do face the economic liberties issues. You'd face it under the state constitution, and you'd face it under the federal constitution, which for a very long time now has been held applicable to the state.
Professor Richard Epstein of the Hoover Institution teaches law at the University of Chicago and also NYU. I'm John Batchelor. I didn't go to law school, but I enjoy to learn about 1765 private property. I'm John Batchelor. This is the new John Batchelor Show on CBS Audio Network.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.